It's 8 o'clock on Wednesday, the 19th of June. You're listening to Morning Ireland with Rachel English and Áine Lawler.
The headlines this morning. Adrian Bailey has been sentenced to life in prison for murdering the Irish woman Jill Marr in Australia last year. The United Nations has expressed alarm at the surge in the number of refugees worldwide. Big advances are reported to have been made at talks in Brussels on drawing up the EU's multi-billion euro budget. And Gardaí have renewed their appeal to people for information on the murders of a mother and daughter in County Kerry at the weekend. With the news in full, here's Brian Jennings.
A court in Australia has sentenced Adrian Bailey to life imprisonment for the murder of the Irish woman Jill Marr last year. The judge at the Supreme Court in Melbourne also sentenced 41-year-old Bailey to 15 years imprisonment for her rape. Speaking outside the court, Ms. Marr's father, George McKeown, said that justice had now been done. From Melbourne, our reporter Katrina Perry.
Mr. Justice Geoffrey Nettle today gave Adrian Bailey a life sentence for the murder of Jill Marr and 15 years for her rape. And he ordered that Bailey must serve at least 35 years before he'll be considered for parole. He said that if Bailey hadn't pleaded guilty, he would have given him a life sentence without any chance of parole. He said given the nature and gravity of the attack, nothing short of life would suffice. Bailey raped and murdered Jill Marr as she walked home last September. She was just 550 metres from her home at the time. Her husband Tom, her parents and her brother were all in court today. After the hearing, Jill's father, George McKeown, thanked the police and prosecutors and said justice had been done. But despite this, Jill would never be coming home. Katrina Perry, RTE News, Melbourne.
The United Nations has said the number of refugees worldwide has reached its highest level in almost 20 years, with an average of one person being displaced every 4 seconds. New figures released by the UN Refugee Agency show that last year nearly 8 million people had to flee their homes, most because of conflict. By the end of last year, more than 45 million people worldwide were refugees seeking asylum or forced to move from their homes to another part of their own country. On this programme, Sophie McGuinness, head of office for the UN Refugee Agency in Ireland, said the conflict in Syria was a big contributing factor to the increased number.
Of the 45 million that have been forced to flee in 2012, half of them have fled from major war conflicts. We see in 2012 that the number of people fleeing from Syria was just under 700,000. Now, obviously, that has escalated massively since then. We're looking at nearly 1.6 million who've left Syria up to the last month of this year. But Syria has played an important role in the rise of the figures.
President Barack Obama will announce today that he'll pursue a reduction of deployed nuclear weapons. In a speech to be delivered in Berlin, Mr. Obama will say he intends cutting such weapons by up to one third below the level achieved in the last New START treaty with Russia. A senior Obama administration official said that the president would also outline the goal of reducing US and Russian tactical nuclear weapons in Europe, pledging to work with NATO allies to develop proposals that could be explored with Russia to achieve this. Considerable progress is reported to have been made in efforts to reach agreement on the EU's next budget, which is worth 960 billion euro. Talks between representatives of EU governments and the European Parliament, which are being chaired by the Taoiseach Eamon Gilmore, will resume at 10 o'clock Irish time. Our Europe correspondent Paul Cunningham.
Securing agreement on the EU's next budget, which will run from 2014 to 2020, is a key priority of the Irish government, which only holds the presidency of the European Council until the end of the month. EU officials say progress has been made in the talks, compromises are currently being examined by MEPs, and the Taoiseach and Minister for Foreign Affairs Eamon Gilmore is still aiming for an agreement to be concluded today. The main sticking points are thought to be demands by MEPs for an increase in the budget allocation for the remainder of 2013, how a review clause will work in the next seven-year budget, and the degree of flexibility which is allowed to move money between annual headings. Another area which could scupper a deal is a push by the European Parliament for what's called own resources, a very sensitive area at EU government level because it involves ideas like an EU tax. Paul Cunningham, RTÉ News, Brussels.
Gardaí investigating the murders of a 27-year-old woman and her 8-year-old daughter in County Kerry at the weekend have renewed their appeal for information. The bodies of Yolanta Lubienia and Enrica were found at their home in Killorglin on Sunday night. Preliminary results of post-mortem examinations confirmed they had died of stab wounds. Sergeant Jim Malloy of the Garda Press Office has appealed to anybody with information to come forward.
Yolanta was alive at about 10 minutes to 2 on Saturday. She was seen walking home wearing a dark coat, dark trousers, carrying a pink and white shopping bag. On her way home, which is about 15 minutes from the centre of Killorglin, now that's Langford Downs. And our appeal would be to anybody who was in the area at that time. It doesn't matter what they saw. We just want to talk to everybody who was in the area, particularly between 12 midday and 7 p.m. last Saturday.
Two men are being detained by Gardaí following the seizure of a big amount of cannabis in Tuam in County Galway yesterday evening. The drugs are estimated to have a potential street value of €400,000. The two men are aged 41 and 49 and were arrested following a house search by Gardaí. Now the time is 6.5 minutes past eight.
It's 8 minutes past eight now. Clodagh Walsh rejoins us to tell us what it says in today's papers.
The picture on the front of the Irish Examiner shows seven Gardaí on their hands and knees searching for the murder weapon around the house of Yolanta Lubienia and her daughter Enrica. As a double murder investigation into their deaths gets underway, the story makes the lead for the Irish Independent, the Star and the Irish Sun this morning. Inside their pages there are pictures of a family in happier times. The editorial in the Examiner concerns itself with the research released yesterday by the advocacy group ADVIC, which shows that 65% of families of homicide victims are dissatisfied with a sentence given to the perpetrator, and it's this story that makes the lead for the Irish Daily Mail. It says that the Minister for Justice is now being urged to introduce minimum sentences for murder similar to those in England and Wales. Elsewhere, the Examiner reports that the chairman of a primary school that sent children home with pro-life abortion leaflets has been forced to resign. Eddie Shaw, chairman of Harold School Board in Glasdoul in South Dublin, announced the move last night after pressure from parents. The pro-life campaign said the situation was an unfortunate mistake. And the budget battle over how the €1 billion promissory note savings should be spent will begin in earnest today. According to the Irish Times, Minister Richard Bruton will insist tax cuts are necessary to sustain economic growth. And that paper reports that the Taoiseach is not concerned by the G8 strategy on tax evasion by multinationals. Inside its pages, however, Arthur Beasley says the plan could spell trouble for our corporate tax regime. You can read the 10 points agreed on tax and in bite-sized pieces what the global leaders promised on trade, Syria, terrorism and aid. Also, who claims credit for what and whether the summit was a success or not. Sean Connolly in the Examiner thinks not. He writes, shame it went out with a whimper rather than a bang and remained as detached from the real world as ever. The same could not be said for the impact Michelle Obama and her family made. There isn't a paper this morning that isn't full of pictures of the family. From Miriam Lord in the Times, Michelle Obama's second day in Ireland was great fun. From the Midges in Glendalough to Bono and Dalkey, a sort of madness took over in the summer sun, and that about sums up the coverage in the papers. The American press, however, according to both the Times and Independent, saw the Obama's Irish experience as rather stale, with reports of glazed expressions and Malia and Sasha looking rather bored. Many of the papers report this morning that the wife of developer Sean Dunn, Gail Killalay, is to be added to the list of creditors in his US bankruptcy case in papers which are due to be filed in Connecticut on Friday. The Mail reports that an IBM worker has told a court that she discovered millions of euro of severe discrepancies in IBM Ireland's sales records. It says she is now facing jail after allegedly transferring files from the company onto memory sticks. When the company found she had downloaded the files and took them home, she was summoned to the High Court. Ex-Coronation Street actor Helen Flanagan, who played Rosie Webster, is the lead for the Irish Daily Mirror. It reports how she feared for her life after armed raiders broke into her home. And finally, back to the Times. Scholars from all over the world will gather in Rome this morning for a 3-day conference on the writings of Brian O'Nolan, better known as Flann O'Brien and Miles Nagopoleen. And the theme of the conference? Problems with authority.
Well, the story dominating our news this morning is a sad and shocking one, and we're going to return next to Melbourne.
Blackburn and the sentencing of Adrian Bailey. He's the man who raped and murdered the Drogheda woman Jill Marr following a night out. As you may know, the case has led to a lot of soul searching in Australia about how someone with such a violent history, and it's worth remembering that Bailey had more than 20 previous convictions for rape and for assault, was at large. Our reporter Katrina Perry was in court again today and she joins us. Earlier, Katrina, you brought us in detail through what happened today and through what the judge had to say. But will you just remind us briefly of what happened?
What happened in court today was the presiding judge, Judge Geoffrey Nettle, issued a 23-page judgment essentially on Adrian Bailey and on the sentence that he should receive for what he did to Jill Marr in murdering and raping her. Judge Nettle handed down a life sentence to Adrian Bailey, and over here in Australia things work a little bit different than they do at home in terms of a life sentence when a non-parole period is set there and then on the day of sentencing, and that can range for anything in the decades depending on the crime. And in this instance, Adrian Bailey has been ordered to serve at least a 35-year non-parole period, so he'll be at least 35 years, maybe more, before he is ever released from prison. He was also sentenced to 15 years for the rape of Jill Marr, and again, that would be at very much on the upper scale of sentences for rape here in Australia, in Melbourne. So the judge recapped essentially what had happened that night last September. For the first time, we've heard some of it from Adrian Bailey's perspective, as Mr. Justice Nettle recapped some of the police interview that Adrian Bailey did 5 days after he had murdered Jill Marr. He described what happened that night in that he'd been out with his partner in a nightclub. They'd had a row. They parted company. He assumed she'd gone home, so he went home when she wasn't there. He took a taxi back into town to look for her. The taxi driver that picked him up said he was so drunk that he was concerned that Adrian Bailey would vomit in his car, so he threw him out on Sydney Road, which is where Jill Marr was walking home, having moments earlier just said goodbye to her work colleague who'd offered to walk her home. But it was a less than 5 minute stroll. So Jill, as we know, said that she was grand and that she'd make that journey herself. We then heard Bailey's account of what happened next. He said that he had then decided to jog the rest of the way home at 1:30 in the morning, to which Mr. Justice Nettle today said he found that very hard to believe, that a man who was so drunk that a taxi driver wouldn't take him the whole journey would be sober enough to jog the rest of the way home. And Mr. Justice Nettle said it was actually his opinion that Adrian Bailey had spotted Jill Marr and had the intent at that point on the main road to rape her. And what happened next was that Adrian Bailey was running up the street. Jill was walking up the street. He eventually caught up with her. He told police that when he caught up with her, she was very upset. That she had just gotten off the phone. We know that she'd gotten off the phone with her brother who lives in Perth, and they were talking about their dad who just had a stroke reasonably recently. She was upset, and Adrian Bailey said he stopped to ask her, was she okay? And he told police, I was just trying to do the right thing. It wasn't my intention to hurt her, you know. So he told police that when he tried to help Jill, in his words, she told him to F off. This really annoyed him, he said, because he was just trying to do the right thing. And he walked on. Now, they were going in the same direction at this stage, and he said she followed him. And then he became more annoyed and she told him to F off again. And at this point, he came back to her. There's a few variations of events here as to whether she called him back, according to him, or he came back of his own volition. He then, as Mr. Justice Nettle put it today, dragged her up a laneway and subjected her to a rape that the judge today described as savage and degrading, and took place over a long time and was potentially life-threatening in itself. After the rape had ended, Jill got very annoyed and hit Adrian Bailey with her mobile phone and said she was going to call the police. He tried to calm her down. He told police he put his arms around her at this stage to try to calm her down. And he says she fell backwards and hit her head. He says he could feel blood behind her head. As Mr. Justice Nettle put it today, having gone through all the evidence and all the police statements, He said that it was in his opinion that Adrian Bailey had intended to kill her and to strangle her, not because of any sort of accident of his hands slipping, as he had initially told police, but either because she was going to call the police or because he had some form of perverted pleasure that he derived from taking her life. But he said either way, in his opinion, Adrian Bailey had intended to rape Jill Maher and then later had intended to kill her.
Now, many people, Katrina, listening to this will find these details very upsetting. So it is almost impossible for us to imagine what this must be like for Jill Maher's family, for her parents, for her brother, for her husband. What did they say afterwards?
Well, all of her family were in court today. They weren't last week because her mum is quite ill herself and didn't make the journey over from Perth. But today her mum, her dad, her brother and her husband Tom were all in court. They didn't flinch when all this evidence was being recapped. As you say yourself, it is quite disturbing and upsetting. And bear in mind that I'm giving you the sort of 8 o'clock in the morning version of events here. But when the life sentence was handed down, they didn't react at all. And then afterwards, as a unit, united together, they came out onto the steps of the courthouse and Jill's dad, George McKeown, made this statement.
Jill lived a life full of family, friends and her beloved Tom. Jill was brutally raped and murdered and is never coming back. Because of Ben Leonard and the team at Victoria Police and Richard Lewis and his colleagues at Public Prosecutions Victoria, justice has now been done. Police and prosecutors, we thank you.
A brief statement there from the Maher family. Katrina, obviously in this country that there has been huge interest in this case. Can you give us a sense of how big it is in Australia? Because as I was saying in the introduction, it has led to a lot of soul searching about how such a man could be walking the streets.
Absolutely, Rachel. Well, since the first day of the sentence hearing last week, when all of those details emerged that Adrian Bailey was in fact on parole and also on bail at the time he attacked Jill Maher, it's dominated coverage here. There's not one day that has gone by that I haven't seen at least one, if not more, articles in the newspapers. It's on the television and radio bulletins. Here today, all of the networks in Melbourne are running special programmes this evening, half-hour, one-hour specials on this, recapping everything. Last week it took up multiple pages in the newspaper the day after court, and I'd expect something similar tomorrow. At the courthouse today, and people will see this in the pictures on my television reports later on, the media scrum was something beyond words. Seasoned court reporters here told me that they have never seen anything like it. And that's people who are on the court beat here in Melbourne for 20 or 30 years. Such was the number of reporters, of camera crews, photographers. It was absolutely huge. They say they've never seen anything like it. In terms of the sentence that has been handed down for Adrian Bailey as well, it's up there with the maximum that has been given at the Supreme Court of Victoria in the past. From what records could show this afternoon, only once before has somebody been given a life sentence with a non-parole or minimum period of 35 years. And that was a guy called Carl Williams, who was a notorious gangland boss here in Melbourne, who got the same sentence that Adrian Bailey has got, that 35-year non-parole period, for ordering three gangland murders and conspiring to commit another. So that just gives you some indication as to how serious the whole community here, the legal community and the people of Melbourne, to have taken this case.
Katrina, thank you very much for joining us. Katrina Perry there, our reporter in Melbourne.
Well, it's the last big challenge of Ireland's EU presidency, which finishes at the end of the month. Securing agreement on Europe's almost €1 trillion budget for the next 7 years. Heads of government agreed a deal last February. They cut spending back to €960 billion. But the EU Parliament has its own ideas and the budget can't be passed without MEPs backing. The Taoiseach and Foreign Affairs Minister Eamon Gilmore joins us from Brussels. Good morning, Taoiseach.
Good morning, Áine.
Are you able, do you think, today, over the next couple of days, to square this circle between EU leaders looking to save money and the EU Parliament looking to spend more?
Well, we've been working on this now for a number of months, and to date we've had 10 formal meetings of one kind or another to try and get agreement on the European Union budget up to 2020. We made a lot of progress last night, and I'm due to go back to meetings again in about a half an hour's time. What's involved here is a very big sum of money, 960 billion euros. To put it in context, we're talking about, in real terms, an amount of money which is about five to six times the Marshall Plan. It's money that we used to always talk about in Ireland, I think, as the money from Europe that built the roads and the ports and funded training and social programmes. This is money that today and over the next 7 years will be used to support the creation of jobs in Europe, supporting, for example, the food industry through the Common Agriculture Policy, supporting research and innovation, the money that goes into universities and into companies for research and upgrading, supporting infrastructure. There's about 100 million in it, for example, for funding for infrastructure projects in the border and Midlands region in Ireland, another 150 million for the peace programme.
It's not the objectives, though, as astonished us so much as the cost. And I mean, this appears to be the point of difference, doesn't it, between EU leaders and the Parliament. Have you been able to make progress there?
Well, you're right, it is the cost, because, of course, this is not money from heaven. This is money that is put up by the taxpayers of Europe, and at a time when every individual country in Europe is tightening its budget and looking at every line that it is spending, it is difficult to assemble this amount of money. Where we have been able to make progress is across a number of areas. First of all, a degree of flexibility in how the money is spent. It sometimes happens, for example, that not all of the money is spent in 1 year. Traditionally, money not spent went back to the member states. We're working on a formula whereby there can be more flexibility in that, and that some money that's not spent in 1 year can be carried forward to the next. The second area that we're looking at is, of course, the period from now to 2020 is quite a long period, and the economic situation in Europe may change, and we all hope that it will improve. And therefore, we are building into what we are agreeing, a midterm review of the budget to look at the economic situation about 2016 or so, and to see if variations can be made on it at that stage. And then the third area is, of course, there are a lot of European budgets and European funds of one kind or another. And I think that a lot of people are a bit perplexed when they hear the European budget and the MFF and the ESM and all of these acronyms. And one of the things that we're attempting to do is to pull those together and to make it a more transparent, so that the taxpayers of Europe can see exactly where their money is going and can see it, if you like, on one page.
And I appreciate you probably don't want to jinx the outcome at this stage, but given that we went into the Irish presidency almost 6 months ago without a budget deal, do you think it's going to end without a budget deal, or can you pull it off?
Well, we're certainly making every effort to get agreement. It is something that has to be agreed by the European Parliament. The members of the European Parliament are hugely important in this. There has to be an overall majority of the entire membership of the European Parliament voting for this. So I would encourage farmers, people who work in the food industry, students, young people in particular, because one of the areas where there's a very big sum of money being provided is for youth unemployment, and that one of the things we want to do with that is we want to bring that forward so that that's spent in the early years of the programme. And I would encourage people who stand to benefit from this budget to talk to their members of the European Parliament and to encourage them to support the adoption of this budget, which is needed to support jobs and investment right across Europe, but in Ireland in particular.
Sounds like you aren't totally certain, although still hopeful of a deal there on the budget. One issue, of course, that's much in the news at the moment and relevant to you, of course, as Foreign Affairs Minister, is the discussions on Syria at the G8 summit in Fermanagh. Agreement on talks, peace talks, but that was already on the cards. No agreement from Russia to change their support for the Assad regime. How disappointed are you in that?
Well, I'm not surprised at it, because Russia has maintained that position right through. And indeed, that has been one of the reasons why the United Nations has not been able to adopt a very strong position in relation to Syria. The situation in Syria is appalling. We're now looking at the latest figure is that 93,000 people have been killed in Syria. 3.5 million people driven out of their homes, many of them in refugee camps in Turkey and Jordan and Lebanon, and indeed signs of instability in some of those countries. There's a huge humanitarian crisis. One of the things that I welcomed in particular from the meeting yesterday was the commitment to provide an additional $1.5 billion in humanitarian assistance. And indeed, today Ireland will be committing another $1.65 million from our aid budget to support the humanitarian effort. Because the people who have been driven out of their homes and who have been driven across borders are now living in very, very difficult circumstances, and they need assistance with food, with shelter, with education and with medical needs. And that is the immediate requirement that the international community has to respond to.
And on the tax equity question that was being discussed at the G8, the Lockyer Declaration saying companies should know who owned them and tax collectors and law enforcers should be able to obtain this information easily. It's all very grand as an intention, but there's no enforcement or obligation there. Is it just fine words?
No, it's not just fine words, and in fact it's something that we have been working on, because again, as part of our European Union presidency, in fact we have been driving forward with new initiatives at a European Union level for the sharing of tax information and for the cracking down on tax evasion. And also at the OECD, which I attended a couple of weeks ago, there is work being done to address the kind of loopholes that exist internationally that allow clever tax planners to find their way around the tax regimes between different countries. So as a country, Ireland is anxious that there would be international effort and international agreement to close the loop. No, it's not a case. It can only be done internationally. We have a very transparent tax regime ourselves, and that's recognised internationally. The problem is that companies with clever tax planners are able to find a loophole between the tax regime in one country and in another. And the only way that you can close that off is by having robust international agreements. There are already some, and Ireland is an early signatory of some of those. We were the fourth signatory, I think, of an agreement with the United States. We are working on further agreements, both at a European Union level and at an OECD level, in order to close off these loopholes.
Does it strike you, Tánaiste, that there might be something a little bit contradictory in talking about tax equity in Enniskillen, while Michelle Obama is meeting Bono for lunch in Dublin, despite Joan Burton having very publicly criticised Bono for U2's offshore tax status?
Well, I have no control over who Michelle Obama meets or who Bono meets. That's entirely a matter for themselves.
You're not concerned about the mixed messages?
No, my view on taxation is that the taxation regime should apply evenly to everybody. I believe that everybody, no matter who they are, should be contributing to the tax system and should be contributing on the basis of their ability to pay.
It's 24 minutes to nine. You're listening to Morning Ireland. Darren Frehel joins us now with the sport. Morning again, Darren.
Good morning to you, Rachel. We're going to begin with horse racing, because the opening day of Royal Ascot was dominated by the Irish. The Jim Bulger trained Dawn Approach won the feature, the St. James's Palace Stakes. Aidan O'Brien won the Queen Anne and Coventry Stakes with Declaration of War and War Command. And Johnny Murta was on board Soul Power, which took the King's Stand Stakes, and Extortionist, which won the Windsor Castle Stakes. I'm delighted to say that Johnny Murta joins me on the line now. Good morning, Johnny.
Morning, how are you?
Good, Johnny. 2 from 2 yesterday. I think that makes it 41 winners at Royal Ascot, a phenomenal record. Why have you enjoyed so much success there?
I've probably been on the right horses on the right days, but it's a huge event. There's a great buzz around the place. I have a great feel for the track. You know, even on the old Ascot, I used to love riding there, but this new place is, you know, it's different class. It's absolutely fantastic. You know, big crowd, big day, the best horse in the world, competing against the best jockeys. So, listen, I've been very lucky.
You switch modes this afternoon, Johnny. You'll have the top hat and the tails on in the parade ring. What are your chances of getting your first win as a trainer at the event today with Sweet Lightning?
Well, he has some chance. You know, he's after winning two Lincolns. He won the Irish Lincoln there earlier in the year. He won the English Lincoln a couple of years ago. He's eight now, but he's lost none of his enthusiasm and his will to win. So I'm hoping for a big run. There's a young guy, Luke Dempsey's claiming £7, so that'll be a big help to the horse. And, you know, I'm hopeful for a big run. And who knows, it just might happen.
You weren't tempted to get on board yourself, were you?
Well, I was tempted, but he had such a high weight. He had 9'10", and, you know, it'd be very difficult to win with that. So he's down to 9'3" now, so that's a realistic weight for him, to give him a chance of winning. And, you know, we're just trying to get another big win. But he does go well, straight mile, big runner handicaps is what he excels in. So, we're again, as I said, we're really looking forward to today. It's a new experience for me, but one I'm looking forward to.
And are you riding out yourself today?
Just riding out here now, yeah. We're just riding out this morning here. Give the horse a little bit of a canter, and I've got one ride in the first. Bit of an outsider, but please God, my luck is in. It might just happen.
Fingers crossed. Look at the Prince of Wales Stakes, the highlight today. Is this going to be a straight shootout between Camelot and Alcazie?
They look like the two horses on form, but there's a French horse in there I really fancy. He's after winning his last couple of races. I'm not sure of his name now, but he's training in France. I think he could be the one to spoil the party. But it's a very open race, that. You know, I know the top two in the market look like it's between the two of them, but a lot of good horses in it. Any horse could win that race. It's ultra competitive.
Okay, just finally, Johnny, four Irish winners yesterday. We have 15 Irish runners in action today. Eight is the record over the 5 days. Can it be beaten, do you think, this week?
Well, after Cheltenham, the kind of jump trainers were kind of sticking their chests out and saying how the good they were doing in Cheltenham, but I think the flat trainers kind of lot to be proud about this, especially yesterday, the way it started. You know, they won the three group ones on the card, and listen, it's the start. Hopefully we can continue through the week, and hopefully Johnny Murtagh can add to one of those trained winners in that.
We hope so. Fingers crossed for you today, Johnny. Thanks a million for taking the call, and the very best of luck today. Now, the British and Irish Lions team to face Australia in the first test will be named tomorrow morning. We have been, though, getting a fitness and health update on the walking wounded this morning, and assistant coach Rob Howley has confirmed that Tommy Bowe and Jamie Roberts are unlikely to be fit. Manu Tuilagi is touch and go for the first test. Better news, though, regarding the fitness of George North. He will be available for selection.
George was up this morning, bright and early, 7 o'clock. He came for a fitness test and never seen him in better shape. And he's available for selection on the weekend, and it's a huge flip for us. We've looked after him over the last week to 8 days, and I think it's a huge morale boost to have someone like George North fit for us. I think that he was involved with the Australia game last year on the tour, and over the last 12 months... I haven't seen him in a more physical, better shape, and that's why we took the decision really to get him 100% physically right. And I'm sure he's looking forward, if selected, to playing against Australia on the weekend. You know, Jamie is progressing. He won today. He's unlikely to be fit for the weekend, as is Tommy Bowe. Once again, the healing process for Tommy is almost at time. Every day he's continuing with his rehab, and it's just making sure that the surgery which he's had, that healing process has taken place. So more than likely with Tommy, he's going to be available for the second test for selection. Manu is improving every day, obviously taking the stinger. The strength is coming back into his shoulder, and obviously he'll be touch and go.
The Irish under-20s were beaten at the IRB Junior World Cup by France 9-8 last night. Liverpool striker Andy Carroll has passed a medical at West Ham. He should complete a €7.5 million move from Liverpool to West Ham today. And finally, Tyrone's Dermot Carlin is in danger of missing the All-Ireland football qualifier against Offaly with a broken nose.
And as chance would have it, just while you were talking there, Darren, the first sports news in a while that hasn't mentioned Joe Kinnear. Well, while you were talking there, a newsflash came in from the Press Association saying that the Newcastle managing director, Derek Lambius, I'm not sure whether I've got that
pronounced. Yeah.
Yeah, that he's resigned from his role with immediate effect, the club have announced on their official website.
Incredible. And Joe actually the other morning hinted that he had resigned prior to actually resigning. So there's definitely something up there at Newcastle.
More follows, as they say. Darren, thank you very much. Now, 100 years on from the 1913 lockout, the legacy of the Workers' Rights Campaign is proving a source of inspiration to a group of adults with an intellectual disability. The Explorers Theatre Group from St John of God, Carmona Services in South County Dublin, recently performed a dramatic interpretation of the strike as part of events to mark St John of God Week. Reporter Louise Byrne met the group of actors who have been exploring what they have in common with the striking workers of 1913.
We're going to go through our play twice. While we're going through our play, I want lovely loud voices. Yeah? Remember, yeah. Coming from yeah. Your belly. Yeah?
Final rehearsals in Mount Town Community Centre, Monkstown, County Dublin. 10 adults with an intellectual disability practice holding their strike signs, taking their stage positions, and remembering lines. It's their interpretation of a 1913 strike, with Elizabeth Oxley playing the most famous striker of them all.
Jim Larkin, he was a good man. A really powerful voice.
What did the workers think of him?
I think the workers kind of like him because they know the world. Just stick together and stand up for yourself.
Standing up for yourself is a concept this group identifies with. Drama facilitator Charlotte Tiernan on the parallels 100 years on.
We were looking at all the things in our play that the workers were looking for, were things like better healthcare, which is still very relevant today. And they were looking for minimum wage, which is still very relevant today. They were looking for better housing and for people with a disability. Better and appropriate housing is something, you know, we have to still considering today. So many of the things that were talked about today are relevant.
Through drama workshops and field trips, the group has been exploring the lockout, even using the iconic Strumpet City as research.
You stand at the gate every morning at 8 o'clock. Out comes the foreman and says, I want you and you and you. Like that, like.
What happens if he doesn't pick you?
Oh, well, you just ramble around to the docks and see if you can get work unloading. If you can't, you just go off home and hope for better luck next time.
Paul Yates, who's a member of the National 1913 Commemoration Committee, has also been lending a hand.
I think 1913, the centenary, is an opportunity to remind people of basic social solidarity values. And I thought it was very appropriate because 1913 is really the 1916 of the marginalised. It's the 1916 of all the people who didn't have anything, whether they suffer from disability of some sort or whether they're poor. This is their 1916.
So are you looking forward to the play?
Yes, I am.
Will you be nervous, Elizabeth?
Yes. I'm starting to get nervous right now at the moment.
Rehearsal's over. It's time for the real deal. A performance in front of friends, family and invited guests.
So lots of the workers got together and decided to join the union.
Liam plays a worker striking for better rights. Sarah is a scab crossing the picket line. And then it's Elizabeth's big moment. Can she overcome her nerves and channel Big Jim Larkin? She stands front of stage, arms aloft.
We need to stick together. And stand up for yourself.
Yeah, my name is Kay. Kay Oxley, I'm Liz's sister-in-law, came to support her today because I knew she was nervous. And they learn an awful lot. I mean, through all this, Liz has learned a lot, haven't you, Liz?
Yeah.
Do you think that this provides something of a voice, maybe, for Liz and her friends?
Yeah, it draws some attention to what they can achieve and what they can do, you know? I mean, to be honest, I wouldn't perform in front of that many people myself.
For the director of Carmona Services, Phil Gray, this type of project is another way to give service users the chance to have their say.
Carmona Services supports about 395 people with intellectual disability, from moderate, severe and profound. The drama piece that you saw today provides them with the opportunities to, I suppose, build up their confidence in speaking out.
The thing about drama is we bring aspects of ourselves into any time we play a role, and we bring aspects of the role into ourselves afterwards. I think we can learn a lot from looking at the past, and I think we have to demand better. And I suppose what I'd like to see is the guys coming from today and demanding better, and a fairer life for them.
Charlotte Tiernan ending that report from Louise Byrne. And you can see the St John of God performance later this year as part of Dunleary Rathdown County Council's Social Inclusion Week.
Now, earlier in the programme, we heard from Noel Giblin, the National Secretary of the Psychiatric Nurses Association. He was talking to us about the situation with acute psychiatric services in Roscommon. The PNA wants Mental Health Minister Kathleen Lynch to step in. There's been increasing local concern following incidents of patients assaulting each other or staff, Gardaí being called on some occasions, and there are two serious incident reviews following the death of one patient and the setting fire of another. New admissions were not accepted last weekend. Dr. Amanda Burke is Executive Clinical Director of Mental Health Services for Roscommon Galway. Dr. Burke, good morning to you.
Good morning, Anya.
From what we heard from local TDs and the PNA, it sounds as if there's a serious problem in Roscommon acute psychiatric services. Do you accept that?
Well, Anya, could I just start by reassuring the people of Galway and Roscommon that patient and staff safety and the provision of a high-quality mental health service is our primary concern. I don't accept that we have a crisis at this moment in time. Across Galway and Roscommon, we have sufficient nursing staff to provide an excellent level of care. However, in keeping with all public services currently, this necessitates redeployment of staff.
So when we hear that patients from St Luke's acute ward in Ballinasloe, when that was closed, were transferred to Roscommon, that that's putting too much pressure, especially given the fall in staffing numbers in Roscommon. Are you saying that's not a problem, that's not a pressure?
Can I just clarify first of all that St Luke's ward was never a secure unit. It was just a locked ward, and indeed it was unsuitable for the management of low numbers of patients. Now, I can't comment on any individual cases, but as far as clinical risk goes, clinical risk is assessed on an ongoing basis daily for every patient, and this assessment includes the treating consultant, the nursing staff and the allied health professionals. And following this, safe operational capacity for our unit is determined.
So is it safe when a female patient is assaulted by a male patient, when two female staff are assaulted and when Gardaí have to be called on a number of occasions?
As I said, Anya, I cannot comment on individual cases. Suffice to say that any or all instances that occur are openly and transparently reviewed in keeping with national guidelines, and the results are made available.
And does that mean you're not going to comment on the death of a patient and the setting fire of another?
I won't comment on any individual cases. I think you'd understand that if it was a family member of your family, you wouldn't want it discussed on national radio.
Well, some family members have gone to the newspapers because they do want this publicised, and they're saying that they were sent away from Roscommon and in fact had to get in touch with the Gardaí, who got in touch with the HSE before they got an offer of a badly needed acute psychiatric bed in Galway.
Okay. No patient was or will be turned away from Roscommon. Patients are assessed by a clinician at the point of presentation and appropriate care given, which may include admission. Now, the Galway Roscommon service is operated as one, and if one unit has reached capacity for whatever reason, admission will be offered in another unit.
And so when a patient is discharged because they're told in Galway they're attached to Roscommon, so they'd have to deal with the staff there, is that all the services working together?
I won't be commenting on any individual cases. Clinicians assess patients and discharge patients. Patients don't always agree with the clinical decisions that are made.
Do you think it's appropriate that the Minister would intervene, given that there, you know, we heard from Dennis Nocton, it's not just the psychiatric nurses, there's a lot of local concern at this. Shouldn't the Minister step in, and would you welcome that?
Well, could I just clarify in terms of our services in Roscommon? We do have sufficient nursing staff, and the PNA mentioned earlier about Vision for Change. Now, we are committed to implementing a Vision for Change, and we're delighted with the Minister's significant investment of new development funds. We have 44 new multidisciplinary posts between 2012 and 2013, including a psychiatry of later life specific team for Roscommon. So, I mean, we are committed to that implementation, and there has been significant investment given into Roscommon and will continue to be given to Roscommon for a high quality community based service.
Dr. Amanda Burke, Executive Clinical Director of Mental Health Services for Roscommon and Galway, thank you for talking to us. It's 2 minutes to nine. Morning Ireland, it's 11 minutes to nine. Well, the United States has announced it's going to be talking to the Taliban at peace talks in Doha, although as one set of talks is announced, President Karzai has, in response, pulled out of security talks with the United States, and it's a sign of the tensions between his government, the Taliban, and the United States as they all try to extricate themselves from the violence that's been going on in Afghanistan and secure a peace deal for the future. Well, earlier this morning, before President Karzai's statement, I spoke to Michael Semple, former European envoy to Afghanistan, about the significance of talking to the Taliban.
The first of all significance is that it's happening at all. For 1 year and 3 months, official contacts between the Taliban and the US have been cut off. After an immense diplomatic effort, they have now restarted, and it's not just a one-off meeting. The Taliban have accepted a platform from which they can engage in dialogue with the US and others, including possibly the Afghan government.
Now, you've been a long-term advocate of talking to the Taliban. What can these talks achieve for each side?
Well, on the positive side, these talks provide an opportunity to find a way out of the conflict. But also, I think for those who would try and sustain the conflict, including hardliners inside the Taliban movement, these talks, frankly, they're going to become an irritant because it's going to become increasingly difficult to sustain the conflict. I mean, the Taliban went into this saying that they were fighting against foreign occupation. Anybody who is following developments and seeing this as a great rush for the exits from the international military forces in Afghanistan knows that there's no prospect of foreign occupation of Afghanistan. The Taliban are either going to have to stop fighting or come up with some other reason as to why they're fighting.
Although whatever happens in Doha, there are many people predicting that really what's going to end up in Afghanistan is a resumption of the civil war now that the outside forces are departing.
Well, that's clearly the risk. This is, the effort which many people are engaged in, both inside the Taliban and outside the Taliban, to come up with some kind of solution. It's not some kind of hippie movement. It is a direct attempt to avert another civil war. It's not just about winding down the existing conflict. It's about trying to avert a new and more dangerous conflict. I know from my own contacts with the Taliban movement that there are many there who are deeply worried about the prospect of being associated with precipitating a new round of civil war. Until now, those people, essentially, their voices haven't been much heard inside the movement. They haven't really called the shots. One way or another, with lots of diplomatic leverage, they've at least won this particular argument in opening up a political front. Some of the hardliners would like to use this essentially as a way of saying that, we're almost a legitimate government and we'll win in the end. They would like to exploit this for political purposes. So I think that there's going to be an important debate inside the Taliban movement in coming months as to whether they use this platform to sort of claim international legitimacy and carry on with the fight, or whether they use this platform actually to seek an understanding with fellow Afghans which can wind down the conflict.
You speak of factions within the Taliban. How broad the range of opinions within it? And who's in charge? Is it still Mullah Omar?
It's a very good question. Essentially, nobody has seen Mullah Omar for a very long time, for several years. So there's no prospect of Mullah Omar turning up for these talks. There's a tussle for the ownership of the Mullah Omar legacy. Whenever somebody wants to do something important inside the Taliban movement, they claim that they're doing it on the say-so of Mullah Omar. I believe that to open these talks, they had to say that they were doing it on the say-so of Mullah Omar. These talks, if they don't deliver, I think you'll find one set of Taliban saying that Mullah Omar would have wanted us to talk and to reconcile, and another lot saying, Mullah Omar would have wanted us to fight.
And that was Michael Semple, former EU envoy to Afghanistan, talking to us about those talks between the US and the Taliban taking place in Doha. President Karzai now pulling out of his own security talks with the Americans.